a real deal. I'll shoot your liver out and hand it to you.
Demetrius, I'm really getting sick of your This is way too early to do a podcast, and I need your availability to open up.
Me? No, man. I think you have me confused with somebody else.
Yeah, you force us to do this podcast so early. I don't like it. Rob's already been up for 6 hours, but us young
I'll tell
guys,
you what. I will make you guys a sincere offer. If you would prefer to do this Monday at midnight or Tuesday morning at 1 a.m., you've got my consent. I will commit to 1 a.m. on Tuesday morning.
Rob, how's that sound?
You know, I'm up at night. I'm up till midnight every night.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not even joking. That might actually make more sense. Yeah, either way.
Ooh, we got options now.
I'm good with about 10 o'clock. That would be 10 till 12. If we went 2 hours, that would be 10 till 12. That would be fine.
Yeah, okay. Okay, we can talk about that. Nate, what do you think?
I think that the listeners do not want to hear this, but we can talk about this off air and that'll be fun. But on the bright side, we got a great introduction that's going to be so entertaining. And so I guess with that, we can just jump into the fun parts of the beginning of the podcast.
And what would that be?
Well, Rob, so we'll start off the announcements basically the same way we have for several weeks now, and that is with a Patreon update. So the Patreon update is the last week has just been spectacular as far as the listener support to the podcast. And it truly, truly is humbling to kind of see the support that the listeners have for not only the podcast, but for the future of the podcast. So I cannot thank enough the people who have decided to jump in and really put their, you know, really put the support behind the podcast. So the new Patreons in the last week are Ryan Harmson, John Dunlap, who is a friend from UW-Madison, the college I go to. He gets an extra shout-out because he demanded it. Mo Bashir, who is another executive supporter, which is the highest level of support that you can actually give to the podcast. And I mean, thank you so much to Mo. It really is humbling knowing that people are, you know, that at that level of support. So thank you so much. Cornelius Wilkins Jr., who I got to meet at the Moscone Cup, and is just a super solid dude and was really fun to hang out with for a couple days. So thank you, Cornelius. John B. Lyles, Sam Tronovich, Ross Copperand, Andy Morris, and Tracy Featherly. And in addition to that, Aaron Taylor, who was a supporter previously, has now upped his support to being another executive a supporter as well. So thank you so much, Aaron Taylor, for all the support that you've done with the podcast from the beginning to now. And as always, I'm going to be super transparent about what happens with the Patreon support. I am going to be buying probably a camera actually this weekend probably. And so next week we are actually on spring break for my college. So I plan on doing a bunch of podcasting. I plan on doing a bunch of videos. I plan on getting out some of the reviews for the carbon fiber shafts that I have. Next week is going to be a busy week for me with podcasting and with videos, hopefully. So make sure that you're not only paying attention to your podcast feed next week, but you're also paying attention to the Facebook page or YouTube, because that's where all of the video content that I create will go, assuming that's of interest. So Thank you to all the new Patreons this week and in the past. We also have given away our first Patreon prize, and the winner of that was Dag Torbjikson. So I will be getting in contact with you. I actually already have gotten in contact with you, and you will be able to choose your prize, and it will get shipped over to Norway for you. I will do another prize for that next week, and then from there, we'll kind of go on a week-to-week basis as to whether or not we do it week-to-week or, you know, once every 2 weeks. But yes, the next drawing should be next week. And then the last announcement that I have is, so last week I created a video via live stream on Facebook that is kind of an all you need to know about the Cue It Up podcast. And this was a suggestion from a newer listener who kind of just got on board with the podcast and wanted to know everything that was offered and where to find everything, and was just super supportive of the podcast from the beginning and wanted to know how they could help. So this was a really good idea that they gave me, and I decided to create a YouTube video, or a Facebook video, I guess, but it's on my YouTube now as well. That is basically just a rundown of everything that you need to know about the podcast. So that would be how you can support it. That would be how you can help grow the podcast, where you can find the content, a little bit of a rundown on my website, where you can find the podcast. If you're listening through a podcast app that isn't convenient, there are a lot of them out there, so I show how to find those. I give a little rundown of the shops and the swag that we have available. And then I just give a little breakdown of all of our social media and what those offer, the exclusive Queued Up group that we have that you could be a part of if you wanted to, all that good stuff. So if you're a big fan of the podcast and that sounds of interest to you, you can always head over to the YouTube page, which is Queued Up Podcast, and find it pretty easily. Or you can head over to the Facebook page and find it pretty easily and watch it. It's a little bit longer. It's like 40 minutes, but it's got a lot of good information in there. If you want more content or want new ways of navigating through the podcast, the Queued Up Podcast world. So that's available out there as well. And I guess that's pretty much all the announcements I have. So I guess we can jump into the shout outs. Rob, would you like to go first?
Well, you know what? I'm going to shout out. I went to a pool tournament this weekend, and I'm going to shout out to Whammo. I just think they did a pretty nice job. It's not easy to run a pool tournament. You get a lot of people are unsatisfied with this or that or this or that. But overall, you know, especially the venue workers seem to me to be just the most pleasant, happy folks ever. To wait on you. And the prices are pretty good, and Whammo gave everybody a little miniature charger, battery charger. And, you know, I haven't been to too many pool tournaments where they actually give you something for nothing. And the prices on food and drinks and stuff wasn't crazy high. Wasn't like the Vegas high. And the conditions were good. Lighting was pretty good. You know, all the equipment was brand new, and the rooms were, you know, not too echoey, not too bad. So that's my shout out to Whammo. He did pretty good this year, I thought.
I was also at that event and had a pretty good time, so I can echo that. It was a good weekend, and we even got to stream both some of your matches and both some of my matches to the Facebook page. So I know a couple of the listeners actually reached out to me as I was playing those matches, saying good out or you suck or all that good stuff. So that was fun. Some of the listeners got to find out why we have no credibility talking about anything that we talk about here, which is exciting.
Yeah, and the things that happen to you when you get older when you play pool. You know, a couple of things this weekend that I'll talk about it if you'd like me to. It's hard to, you got to try to eliminate things going through your mind. Of course, if you want to play good pool, and when you're older, there's things that creep into your mind that have no business even being there ever, much less in the middle of a pool tournament. So that is my shout out. Whammo, way to go.
All right. Demetrius, would you like to go next?
Sure. So today I would like to shout out to Peyton Greedis. So, I received an email from a gentleman, Jason, out in Boise, Idaho. Drawn to find a lot of pool players out in Boise. They're on their way. But in any case, he was telling me a little bit about some things that I might mention. But one thing that I thought was pretty cool is his son, Peyton, 11 years old. He's playing 15 hours with him a week, you know, practicing and playing together. And, you know, I talked about in my last Coach's Corner, I talked about the three-time drill. And this 11-year-old, Peyton, he's been trying to work his way through this three-time drill because he thought it was cool, and he's listening to the podcast, he's practicing with his father. And I'm like, man, I've got, like, friends that are professional level that don't, you know, that are struggling with that drill. And I was, you know, I was kind of throwing it out there. But anyway, he's taking it on. He's trying his hardest. He's trying to learn the game. He sounds real passionate, committed, and
I don't know. There's something about that that just, I just want to tip my hat, and, you know, that's a lot of dedication and passion, and look forward to seeing, you know, when you take youth and passion and dedication, you put it all together, that that only goes to one direction, which is I expect we're going to have a fun ride. So anyway, if nothing else, I'm glad he gets to have something to share with his dad, and hope that I get a chance to meet him someday.
Yeah, for sure. I think maybe today, before league, I'll get a little bit of practice in, maybe, or certainly sometime in the next week. I'm gonna live stream that drill that you were talking about, the three times drill, and I'm gonna try that out and see how tough it is. It sounds like a really, really cool drill. How do you get that?
Yeah.
How do you get that started though? Is that you just rack up five or six balls and break them out, or do you just kind of throw them up on the table?
Well, you know, it depends. I mean, for this one, I think I just kind of throw them on the table. You know, the sometimes you can throw six on the table, and the, you know, I just usually what I'll do is I'll throw six on the table and take one off, and I'll just kind of take the one off that I think makes the drill interesting, but not undoable. You know, if you have them too easy, you know, there you don't learn anything from it. If you have them too difficult, you won't make it to the three ball. So somewhere in between.
Oh man, I'm gonna throw on six. I'm gonna break six, and I'm gonna run. This is a great.
So I'll tell you right now, this is a great proposition bet. I have a couple. I'll tell you guys, I've got two proposition bets that'll break the bank. This three times drill does not sound difficult, and I'm telling you, you will find. I mean, I worked through it with a student on Saturday, and I was able to run through a couple of layouts that were not hangers, and I was really, I felt like I ran 100 balls to get, you know, I mean, almost. It was, I felt pretty proud of myself for working through these layouts, and I mean, my cue ball's pretty tight. And then another one, I'll tell you, my ultimate prop bet, Rob, you might like this too, the reverse handspan. So I wanted to find a way to communicate to my students that this is a game of inches, and so one thing I could do is, you've heard of the spot, the handspan, where after every shot, you get to move the cue ball, you know, one hand width in any direction. As a handicap, you get to move the cue ball to your favor. So I tried to do the reverse handspan. I'm like, oh, I play good cue ball. I play good patterns. Let me try the reverse handspan with the six ball ghost. And I'll tell you, I had zero chance to beat the six ball ghost with the reverse handspan. And I mean, it was like every time I shot, I'm shooting off a rail or over a ball or behind a ball or getting the flat angle, which leads to, you know, it was, you know, getting thinner, getting fuller. It was impossible. And I'm looking at my hand. I'm like, man, I'm talking like, you know, whatever, 6 to 8 inches. It's like, how can, I mean, I play to a spot. My cue ball is super tight. Like I feel like I play with ball in hand at every shot. How can I not beat the reverse handspan ghost? And I'll tell you, when you have to move the cue ball 8 inches the wrong way on every shot, it made the six ball ghost absolutely unrunnable. And had you, like, if I go up to Alex Tagalian and offer him the reverse handspan, like, he might feel like, well, I'm elite. I have ball in hand in every shot. My cue ball's so tight. My shot making so good. That sounds like, it sounded to me like I thought I could maybe beat the six ball ghost like that. So anyway, that's like a serious ringer prop bet against a good player. And because it is impossible. And I would say that this three time drill, it sounds like, well, I mean, if you can do it once, you know, you can do it three times. Trust me, you're going to find out that is a serious hill to climb.
Like I said, I'm going to try it at some point in time. So everyone's going to get to laugh at me because I think it sounds like it's going to be tough, but it doesn't sound like it's going to be anywhere close to undoable. And everyone's going to get to laugh at me because they're going to watch me fail at it, which is going to be exciting. So I guess we can move on from that and we can go into my shout out, which will go to Brandon Jacoby. So this past weekend at the WAMO tournament that Rob and I were both at, I actually became a dealer for Jacoby Custom Cues. And it's just because there's been a couple people that have reached out to the podcast and have been interested in Jacoby Custom Cues as a product. So I figured it'd be a good idea to just become a vendor, and then I could, you know, help out some of the listeners who have come to me in the past and who may come to me in the future. And it's just one more way of, I guess, creating more of a all-around one-stop shop for some of the listeners to, I guess, get the equipment that they need or all that good stuff. So know that in the future, I will not be pushing it. I will not be like constantly advertising it or anything, but I will be a Jacoby dealer going forward for the podcast. So if there's anything that you've ever wanted from Jacoby, you can reach out to me now and I can hook you up. And I guess with that, we can jump into the podcast. So there was one big event that happened this past weekend, and it was the Scottie Townsend Memorial 2020. This kind of seemed to be one of the only big tournaments that was this past weekend. Anytime that that's going to happen, there's going to be a bunch of really, really good players. But ahead of the events that are coming up, like the Diamond 10 Ball Open and the Predator World 10 Ball, and for those events that are coming up, there definitely seem to be a huge amount of players coming into town that wouldn't normally be here. So they kind of seem to swing through this tournament on their way to Las Vegas. And because of that, there were just a huge amount of monster players in this event. We can start with the one pocket, which is finished up. And that had Francisco Bustamante beating Justin Hall in the finals, 6-3. So second place obviously goes to Justin Hall then. Third place goes to Dennis Arcoyo. And fourth place goes to Jeremy Jones. And then fifth, sixth goes to Josh Roberts and Sky Woodward. So bit of a surprise maybe that Alex Pegulayan went 3-0 in this event. I mean, how can you have much of a tougher draw than he did, I guess? So I guess it doesn't seem completely unrealistic. He plays a squeaker against Corey Duell and loses just narrowly. And then has to play Tony Chohan on the first round of the one-loss side, and then Dennis Arcoyo in the second round on the one-loss side. So, that's a pretty, I guess in a tournament like this, everything's a tough draw, right?
Yeah, so Tony Chohan went 2-0 then?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that just kind of goes right there. Well, I'll tell you what, the one thing that I'm kind of glad I dodged a bullet on is that I saw that, so good for Justin Hall. I mean, he got to the finals. Again, now he just got to the finals of the Derby one pocket and got it to Hill, of course, against Billy Thorpe. And now here he is again in the finals of a one pocket tournament. And Boosty's Boosty. So on paper, I Boosty in a vacuum, I would say he's a favorite. But I actually felt like, after Justin came so close at Derby, I felt like he might have actually been, a favorite to just outrun the nuts just because, now here he is in the finals again. I thought he was just going to find a way to put it away and be like, you know what, this time I'm winning. So I actually am glad that I was kind of tied up and I didn't get a chance to get a bet down. I don't know that I would have bet on him even, but if I could have gotten any kind of odds on that match, I might have taken Justin Hall just because I felt like he was ready to pop something off here. But anyway, I dodged a bullet. But really, in all sincerity, I want to congratulate him. What a great performance to go back-to-back finals in those two events. So good job to Justin.
I actually, I did watch a decent amount of this earlier on in the event. And I did get to watch the Francisco Bustamante versus Sky Woodward and the Francisco Bustamante versus Chip Compton matchups. And actually, I got to watch Francisco and Gomez too. Boosty he's just so solid. I feel like we're saying this every single week. He doesn't do anything overly flashy. He doesn't have a huge stroke that he throws on a lot of shots. He just puts his head down, grabs his lunch pail, and wins matches. It's crazy that he could be dominating over three decades like he has and still be kind of at the top of his game.
Yeah, what I think is really impressive about Boosty is, he's got a balance, and he's not the only one. I mean, I think all the elite, a lot of the elite players, and especially like historic, Hall of Fame level players, have that ability to balance, really powerful strokes and firepower with good percentage play and good cue ball control and good decision making. So, you've got guys that are a little bit too tight and they, strategic, but not necessarily, they don't have that same level of ammo in their arsenal. And then you've got people that are very aggressive, but are maybe they leak off too many opportunities, whatever reasons, mentally or just kind of a little reckless, I guess. And the top players, and I'll tell you, Earl, people think that Earl was just a shot maker, just all aggression. But if you watch, his cue ball and patterns are as good as anybody's. I mean, people always like, oh, Efren shot the patterns and the cue ball and Earl was the shot maker. It's like, no, Earl, if you watch like his match with Shane on the 10-foot table, his cue ball and patterns was like Buddy Hall's. And so the same thing goes for Boosty. I mean, the guy's got tremendous firepower, but he makes good decisions. He manages the game really well, plays the score, plays the percentages, plays the angles, and but then he also, it just seems like he can play safe for half an hour, and then when he has a spot shot off the end rail, somehow he's still in stroke. And to me, I don't really understand it. It's just a testimony to like how loose he is, how comfortable he is, how much pool he's played, how powerful his stroke is, to where it just seems like it's always right there. He never goes into that one pocket coma mode. And I think that's it. You know, you get a guy who grew up playing 15 ball rotation on tables with wet cloth, and all of a sudden you have him playing, you know, one pocket on a diamond with fast cloth. And it just seems like the guy's got all the adrenaline and all the firepower he needs. And he just moves the cue ball around real well, waits for his chance, and then he finds a way to tear the ball and rip open the rack and run balls from everywhere. And it's a heck of a combination, you know?
Yeah, for sure. It's definitely fun to watch. So I guess that's kind of, we can wrap up the one pocket discussion there, and we can move on to the nine ball main event, which also went on obviously at this event. And this might be the breakout for this player. I mean, he's kind of been battling around the, you know, he'll get thrown in for like a second place, a third place every now and then, fourth, fifth, sixth, something like that. But he hasn't had like a huge win yet. And that is James Aranis. And James Aranis wins the chair over Shane McMinn. And then Josh Roberts comes through the one loss side and completes the first win of the second set. And then James Aranis wins in the double dip. So this might be, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong if you remember something, but this is one of the first huge wins for James Aranis. And for the actual, for the quality of players that are in there, this is and very, very good finishes for Josh Roberts and Shane McMinn as well. If you look at the bracket, so I guess I can go through some of the places in here while I'm here. Billy Thorpe gets fourth place. Fifth, sixth goes to Jeffrey DeLuna and Tony Chohan. Dallas Broussard and Roberto Gomez gets 7th, 8th. But then if you look through this bracket, Dennis Arcoyo's in this. John Salim is in this. Nayuki Oi, Francisco Bustamante, Justin Hall, Ulysses Yap, Sky Woodward, Rob Saez, John Gabriel, CJ Wiley, Warren Kiamko, Sharik Sayed. I mean, there is a bunch of really, really, really top players who did not even make it into the money. It's Tony Chua. Even going back even way back into like 3-4 matches into the tournament, Jonathan Hennessy didn't make it very deep into this tournament. He's a great player. Ulysses Yap only won 2 matches. I mean, Ulysses Yap is a world quality player. He's really, really, really good, and he only won 2 matches in this event. This was a really, really tough tournament. So that is a great finish for James Aranis.
Yeah, I wonder why. Do you guys think that, you know, James, like, you watch him play and he is so relaxed. Like, if there's ever a pool player that shows no signs of tension, it's James Aranis. In fact, I had a student over. We were looking at different players and I wanted him to see James just because no matter what, it never looked like he ever flexed a muscle in his body, including like the break shot or pressure shots or stroke shots. It just looked like he was always so relaxed and he just let the acceleration of his cue do the work. And it hardly looked like he was ever doing anything hard. And so a guy, he looks so comfortable and relaxed. My question is, do you think that the fact that he hasn't won a big tournament as good as he plays, do you actually think that he's struggled with nerves and performance anxiety and confidence? Or do you think that it's just variance that, you know, you get to the finals against good players and you don't always win and he's just kind of had a tough string and, you know, or a little of each? Like, how come you guys, how does that happen where a guy like him hasn't been, you know, especially as many tournaments as he's played, why hasn't he won more majors?
Well, I think it's just he hasn't been, I mean, he's been in the U.S. now for maybe probably 3 years or so, 2 to 3 years, somewhere like that. He's been with Roy. And yeah. I mean, he brought him over here kind of as a project. I say that in the most respectful way possible. I mean, it's not like he couldn't play when he came over here, but I mean, he was brought over here by Roy basically because he was an up and coming player. And, you know, Roy was going to work with him. So, I mean, when you're working with somebody and you're working with their game, it's going to take a little while to get them to that level. And I think maybe just in the last 4 to 5, 6 months, he's really blossoming into one of those top level players that, you know, he's the next in line for being a top Filipino player. It seems like everybody's a, all of the top places in these tournaments are going to Filipino players these days. But, you know, it's, I think it just took a little while to get him to that world quality level that he's kind of gotten into in the last 4 months.
Well, and I will, Rich, and I was at the Super Billiard Expo last year, and he did win the pro event at the Super Billiard Expo, which may not have been at the same density of as like a U.S. Open or a World Championship, but it was definitely on par with the Turning Stone or something like that. And yeah, I think he beat Oscar Dominguez in the finals. Maybe I'm wrong on that. I can't remember now. But anyway, it was he's been playing pretty strong for a few years. But and by the way, I wanted to correct when I was like, well, how come he hasn't won more majors? That was not an insult or like anything, like he doesn't have what it takes to get the job done in the finals. It was more of a compliment, which is he plays so well that I agree, he's destined to just be around the scene for many years and a very dominant player. And I don't think there's any kind of mental block. I just feel like the guy, like you're saying, you just need opportunities to play, and he's been playing a lot, and he's been making a lot of deep runs, and these are just the first spatterings of rain in a thunderstorm.
Yep.
Yeah, you can take and look back at your in hindsight, you know, each time you play in a tournament, and say the average in the tournament is 750 or better, these Fargo numbers, and prep maybe even up toward the 800s. And you think, well, gee, I didn't win. Here I am in a top 10 again in a professional tournament, 20, 30 best players in the world here or whatever in the United States. And how come I can't win everyone? And so when you look at the quality of play, and you look back at how you played and didn't win, why you didn't win, you know, you're looking at probably some very, very minor mistakes. Maybe in a whole match, something like one bad position shot or one miss or
yeah. One drive break.
Or the break didn't, the balls, that particular rack where they were just all laying really ugly.
Yeah, and this
and
is
going
a race
from
seven,
A to B to C to D wasn't no easy task. Yeah, something like, or you had two racks like that, your opponent didn't have any. You know, or maybe your opponent missed a shot and left you bad, and you lost a whole match because of that one mistake. When that level, that skill level gets above a certain point, you know, those minor differences are really large differences. And it can hold you back from winning. You know, these guys don't, the same guys aren't winning every one. You know, they will repeat during the year as champions possibly, but not, you know, not back to back to back, not that dominant every single tournament. This guy is the favorite.
Well, one thing that I think you're bringing up, and I've had a chance to see that people know this, or they think they know this, or they understand it, but they don't get to see it as often if you're not actually going to these tournaments, which is how everybody in the world dogs it and everybody in the world loses a lot. And so you can take, you know, you
one
can
guy
take
wins.
Yeah, and you can take your favorite players. You can take your favorite players and maybe Josh Filler or maybe, you know, Shane Van Boning or maybe Jason Shaw, whoever, you know, or Dennis, whoever your favorite player, Alex, and you go to tournaments enough times and watch them play. And, you know, look at, you know, you were just talking about how Alex got three and out of the one pocket and Shohan went two and out of the one pocket, all these things and all these good players that ended up not making it to the finals of the rotation event. And it's like, in the end, you kind of look at it, it's like, man, Shane at Derby, he played four events, the Bigfoot, the one pocket, Banks, the nine ball. He didn't make a run in any of those things. No, I mean, I think he top 10'd the Banks. Question marks, like something, but like basically he got eliminated. He lost eight matches, you know, in short order effectively, and didn't make any kind of a run in any of those events. And so that's like, you look at a guy like Shane, how do you go get blasted out of all four events when you play that good. And then, but then you look the week before, he won the Turning Stone. So it's like, people don't care about, I mean, you don't get measured by the losses. You get measured by the wins, but everybody loses. And then all of a sudden one day, it comes together, and that's how you measure champions, is how many matches did they win? How many tournaments did they win? And I wish that, and the other thing is they play badly. I remember in the finals watching Mika Immonen play Ralph Souquet to win his back-to-back U.S. Opens. And I remember, like, Ralph Souquet was the one player that I had never really seen just die. Like, I'd never really seen him struggle. Like, I've always seen him play high level. And I was like, I was saying that to somebody. I'm like, he's the only guy I've never seen just melt down and dog it. And he melted down and dogged it. I'm like, well, that completes my checklist. Like, I've seen everybody dog it. I've seen everybody struggle. And we don't get to see that because as an audience, we always see the people in the finals on the stream. Mm-hmm. So we're watching the top 10 in the world, and then we're watching them on their best day when they're running good, playing good, and having the week of their life. And when you watch the top 10 in the world having their best day, you can get this illusion that everybody just plays great. But the reality is it's a very difficult game. And if you watch those same two people in the finals in an early round, the following tournament. Yeah. So anyway, there's a lot of dogging it, a lot of struggles, and there's a lot of variance, and everybody loses a bunch. And it's good to remember that. Cause if you look up any one player and see how often they lose, you might get the impression like, wow, this guy is losing all the time, but they all lose all the time.
They're human.
And they're playing against players.
Even though they don't look like it when they're firing balls in at one after another, we're playing perfect shape. They are human. You can see it too, even in the finals of the big tournaments, if it's close. And those last few games, they don't play the same. The arms are a little tighter, and the shape isn't quite as good, and decision-making maybe not as quite as good. Those last couple of games.
Yeah. So I guess we can wrap up the discussion there. I will also talk about the women's, because they also had a women's event. They do not document this nearly as well as the men, so it's a little bit harder to find information on it. But Janine Lee gets first place, and Ellen Robinson gets second place. And then third place goes to Robin Petrino. I think it's Robin Petrino. So they do not have their own bracket that I'm seeing online. They just have a paper bracket. So that is basically the information that I'm able to get on this. And I guess with that, we can move on to the upcoming events. This next, 3 week stretch of pool, if there's a better 3 week stretch of pool, you'd have to point it out to me, because I don't think it exists. And that is because we get the Diamond 10 Ball Open, the Predator World 10 Ball, and the World Pool Masters, all in back-to-back-to-back fashion. So I'm ridiculously excited for these next few weeks. And luckily, I have spring break starting next week for my schooling. So next week is going to be all podcasting and watching pool, which I'm pretty excited for. So I'll go into the Diamond 10 Ball Open, some of the players in the field. It's a 128-person field. And I think it's literally the 128 best players pretty much in the world, taking into account that some players can't get here because of the coronavirus. But looking at the field, I see David Alcaide, Darren Appleton, James Aranis, Justin Bergman, Francisco Bustamante, Carlo Piatto, Jungling Chang, Ruslan Chinnikov, Jeffrey DeLuna, Corey Duhl, Max Eberle, Matt Edwards, Niels Fine, Joshua Filler, Pia Filler, which I think is his wife, which is cool. Thorsten Holman, Mika Immonen, Conrad, Eklanti Kachi, Alexander Kazakis. I could keep going, but this, I'm not even halfway through this list, so that just doesn't make for great podcasting. Shane Van Boning, we'll say, as a final person. It's literally some of the best players in the world, so I don't know. Did we want to take a stab at talking about this event, who we think's going to win?
Well, I'll tell you, the name that I'm excited to hear is Chang, JL Chang. He was missing at the Derby. I wasn't sure with the coronavirus what was going to happen to our participation among, you know, the next few international events. And I'm really glad that he's going to be in the field, because when I was talking about the best of the best a moment ago, I was mentioning, you know, Filler and Shaw and Shane, and it just goes to show how short pool players' memories are. Chang, he belongs on any list when it comes to the best in the world. And we haven't seen him. I haven't seen him play in a U.S. tournament for, you know, since last year. Since I think maybe this event or the U.S. Open last year. So I'm very, very excited to have him back. Looking forward to his performance. All right, so I'm going to go ahead and make a prediction. I'm going to go ahead and call just for nostalgia and for excitement to have him back in the field. I'm going to pick my man, J.L. Chang.
And who would be one like a dark horse that you would have in this event?
Ooh, let me think about that. Rob, who's your favorite pick?
I'm going to go with Shaw.
Jason Shaw's been winning just about everything, so I could definitely see how that'd be a good pick. I do not have a short memory, and while he hasn't won any events recently, I still think the best player in the world is Joshua Filler. And, you know, he's got a great break. He's got more runout power than I think just about anybody else in the world has right now, and he's fearless. So I'll take Joshua Filler and be boring. So now we can take a dark horse in the field. Somebody that maybe not be well as well known as other players, but who you think could storm through the field and have a top, you know, three or four finish, or maybe even win it. Do you want to start it, Rob?
Dennis the Menace Okoye.
Wow, has pool gotten tough enough that Dennis is a dark horse? Is that how tough the next is?
I know, that's kind of funny, isn't it?
I'm kind of glad I'm staying home.
I know.
Well, I guess I'll take the dark horse of Shane Van Boning then. I mean, this guy hasn't won an international tournament. No, seriously, he hasn't won a tournament for years, it seems like. I'm being mean to Shane. I've probably forgotten a few. I mean, like I said, he won Turning Stone. But Shane, it seems like with these international fields, I have yet to see him get through a field like this for a while. And so I actually feel like if you're going to pick Dennis as a dark horse, I'll pick Shane as a dark horse.
Well, I am going to stick with the heart of this, or at least the spirit of it. And I'm going to pick Ulysses Yap. And I think a lot of he may or may not be on a lot of people's radars at this point. I'm not totally sure. But Ulysses Yap is he's on the national team for Singapore. And he's won a couple of Southeastern Games, Southeastern Olympics or whatever they call it. I think the Southeastern Games, which is basically just like the Philippines and Singapore. And I think Taiwan plays in those. Maybe China plays in them. I don't think China does, though. It's kind of like Southeastern Asia. And they just basically get together and play a bunch of events. So he's won a couple of those. He's definitely an up-and-comer. Yeah, he's a monster, especially when he plays 10 ball. He's a really, really, really good pool player. So he's going to be my dark horse to make a deep run in this event.
Cool. I'll be watching for him.
We can also talk we won't talk about the Predator World 10 ball, but because that starts on March 15th. So the next time we do a podcast, it will be going on. But just know that the Diamond 10 ball open starts on the 11th, and the Predator World 10 ball starts on the 15th. So keep those on the radar and make sure that you're watching them, because this next 3 weeks is going to be some of the best pool that we get to watch. So,
well, I want to say about that is I saw Koping Chung versus Shaw in the finals last year. Filler. Well, he was the first person to beat Filler after Filler stormed through the World Championship and the U.S. Open. And I'll tell you, Filler got to the finals again. It looked like it was his tournament. Looked like nobody could beat him. And when Koping Chung won that match, that was, in my opinion, that was one of my favorite pool matches I've seen in the last 5 years. It was chilling to watch somebody on such a roll as Filler. And to see, I mean, Koping Chung is a deserving champion, but man, it felt like David and Goliath right there. And it didn't look like the job could be done. And to see how calm and cool and collected Koping Chung was, and how he was able to rise to the occasion and just string racks together, that was a one of my favorite matches of the decade. And so I'm really looking forward to that event again. And I just have fond memories of that event because of that one match.
Yeah, for sure.
I'd just like to add, this is a local tournament going on now this next week for any players interested in watching some three cushion play at the Billiard Club. I believe it's in St. Paul, North St. Paul there. Not too far off of 35W. That's going to be going on this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And there'll be 10 guys playing in that. I believe Freddie Lommers is going to play. Brian Half, Mike Miller, John Logan are just a few of the players that are going to be in that tournament. And come and watch. There's a little gallery, upstairs gallery, to watch them if you'd like. So I thought I'd mention that.
All right.
Yeah.
For sure. So now we can move on to the end of the podcast. Okay, so I have a discussion topic that I would like to talk about. And this was a situation that came up this past weekend. So 2 weeks ago, so Wisconsin has, I think, 4 different state pool tournaments. Each of them are different organizations. So last week we had the WSBA, and this week we had the WAMO event. They have different rules. WSBA plays off of BCAPL rules, and WAMO plays off of VNEA rules. So the big difference between those two is one has the WAMO has a neutral 8-ball until the ball is pocketed, and it is not Texas Express, meaning that a foul on the break is ball in hand in the kitchen, where BCAPL is ball in hand anywhere. So the very, very first game that I came into this WAMO with was against the player, and he broke and scratched off of the break. And I took ball in hand anywhere on the table. And
he didn't tell you.
Yeah. Well, not only did he not tell me, as I was down on the shot shooting, he was like, I kind of caught him out of the corner of my eye. He was running basically at the table. And when I was kind of going through on my follow through and I kind of caught him out of the corner of my eye, you see something running at you out of the corner of your eye, whether you're shooting or not, you kind of notice it. And he runs over right away and he yells ball in hand, or he yells foul and grabs the cue ball really quickly. And he basically pushes me out of the way just to get to this cue ball. And so I'm just, you know, there is definitely a debate as to whether or not you could tell your opponent about it. You're playing in a team event where you have 4 other people relying on you. But, well, we won't even talk about, like, I felt very disrespected, basically, that this guy just basically sprinted up to me and pushed me out of the way to get to the cue ball while he yelled foul. But the discussion I would like to have now is, in a situation like this, pool is considered, quote-unquote, a gentleman's game. What would you have done in that situation? Would you tell your opponent?
Yeah, I tell him every time.
And Demetrius?
It freaks him out when you're so honest. It's a form of sharking, just being honest.
Right.
Yeah. They go, oh my God, he didn't let me commit a foul. He told me I was going to and I stopped. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that there's an interesting distinction, and here's the distinction that needs to be made. Is it a strategic error or is it a rules error? And so I think that in this case, I think we're all in agreement that it's, you got to tell your guy, hey, it's in the kitchen. Here's why. It's because 8-ball is the game where there's more variations of rules in 8-ball than any other game. Although the 9-ball break is getting to be anyway. So there's quite a few rule variations in 8-ball, and so these are things that you should mention. Now, in general, I would say that the opponent is typically supposed to play the role of the referee. So they're not supposed to help you if you're making a strategic error. So, Rob, if you're shooting the 8-ball and there's still a stripe on the table or your stripes, they're not supposed to say, hey, no. Look out, sir, there's a stripe on the table, because here's why. It's because, you know, but there's these questions come up and there's a lot of conversation about that. Like, should your opponent, quote-unquote, good sportsmanship point out that you still have a stripe on the table if you're preparing to shoot the 8-ball? And in that case, the answer is no. because they're playing the role of a referee.
Right.
And the referee, the referee's job is not to call your attention to a bad decision. Because where do you draw the line? Do you say, hey, I know you're going to go for this, but that's a low percentage shot.
You're shooting the wrong shot, buddy.
Yeah, you have an easy safety. So you're not supposed to give advice to your opponent, even if it seems gentlemanly. But the difference is that a referee, and maybe I'm wrong, so maybe you guys could, you know, there's a lot of guys that are rules lawyers that have the BCA rule book out or whatever, but I do think it's the referee's job to inform the player of the rules. And so I don't know though if you went to a match with a professional, if you went to a professional match with a referee, and let's just say it was break from the box, and you didn't know it was break from the box, and it's a refereed match, and you get the break, and you start breaking off the side rail, does that referee correct you, or do they just let you break off the side rail and take ball in hand? I don't even know the answer.
I had a match with Scotty Tollefson over in Minnesota one time about 10 years ago, and this happened. It was ball in hand in the kitchen, one of John Stitch's tournaments, and it was winner breaks, race to five, and I broke and scratched, and he put the ball, you know, in the middle of the table, was going to shoot a shot, and I went, Scotty, no, you know, the rule for the tournament is in the kitchen. It was the first game of the tournament, first match. And he went, oh. And so he did put it in the kitchen, and he ran five racks. I never shot.
Wow.
He broke and ran five.
But you slept like a baby knowing that
you lost. And after the set, you know, he went, wow. I feel bad. He said that you didn't get a turn. I went, no, man, you shot great. Don't feel bad.
Well, no. So, but to my question, do either of you guys know the answer to that? If I played a pro nine ball tournament, it was break from the box. It's a refereed match. If I got ready to break off the side rail, would they stop me, or would they just let me break and then call a foul?
No, that's what they do. They'd let you break and call.
No,
a foul.
I think they stop you.
I don't think so.
I think that they stop you.
I've seen it happen.
Okay, that might be a tournament director thing that is decided before the event.
That's probably my guess. BCAPL.
Well,
I think I'm gonna post this question on AZ Billiards. We've got guys like Bob Jewett and some very seasoned pool players that know that. Because if that's the case, and now listen, Nate, I would still tell you, and I think it's the right thing to do. Especially given what I said about how 8-ball, there's so many rules versions. I think it's courtesy, but I think it's good sportsmanship, and I think it's etiquette. Especially in 8-ball at the amateur level, for sure. I am curious what would happen in a pro event, because if the ref would let you break illegally and then call foul, then at the same time, I think the opponent is supposed to, in spirit, play the role of the referee. And if the referee's job is to let you go ahead and foul if you don't know the right rule variation, if that's how the ref would handle it, in a refereed match, then I think it's okay for an opponent to follow that lead, even if I don't necessarily agree with that in that case. Mainly because it's an amateur tournament and it's 8-ball and the rules. I think the fact that there's a million rule variations and it's an amateur event change that, but in a pro event, I'd let you, you know.
I think refs are just there for an after the fact explanation and ruling. They're not there for before you do something wrong. To keep you from doing it wrong or enlightening you, because you're supposed to be responsible.
I'm
going to
push back on that a little bit,
knowing
Rob.
The rules.
I'm going to push back on that a little bit because I think that's a tournament director type of decision as to whether or not the refs actually play that role or not. But I want to before we get any further in this, I want to push back on something that you said earlier, Demetrius, that I haven't had a chance to yet. In the situation where that Rob had, where he shot his 8-ball in and still had a 9-ball on the other side of the table. I actually would still tell my opponent before he fired the 8-ball in. I disagree with you on that one.
You probably don't have shape on that ball anyhow.
Well,
if you're playing shape on the 8-ball and the other ball's on the other end of the table, best you're going to have is a cut or a bank.
Yes, and that's probably true.
If you can even see it.
Yeah, I would tell my opponent on that one regardless too. Just because it's kind of the same spirit of the thing, right? I mean, you're watching your opponent kind of. You know, make a mistake that's going to cost them probably the game.
You fire the 8-ball in before your other ball's in. It's not probable.
Well, you have to make the 8-ball, right? That's my point.
Straight in shot, you're probably going to make it.
Well, it's a hypothetical situation. We don't know that it's straight. Regardless.
Yeah.
Regardless, my point is it's the same kind of, at our level at least, it's the same. If you make that mistake and somebody, you know, Brian Urlacher's you out of the way so they can grab the cue ball and scream foul in your ear. At the level that we play at, that's probably going to be a run out anyways, right? You're probably losing the game.
Imagine how excited that player was, knowing you were about to fall.
I got tackled out of the way. I know exactly how excited he was. But I would tell my opponent, I think, on that one too. So, I just wanted to push back on that one a little bit.
There's a lot of different levels of play. And what I can inform you of is that, you know, of course, at the pro level, if a player shoots the wrong ball, nobody stops them. It's not the referee's job to stop them. And another player is certainly not going to, as playing the role of a referee in a non-refereed match, they're never going to stop a guy from playing. So to me, if you're playing a friendly game and you want to play, if that's how you want to play, to me, that's kind of like telling another guy he's about to shoot the wrong ball, to me feels, because I play
Have you ever done that, Demi?
So to me, I feel like that's like playing where, hey, your cue ball stopped on the rail. Let's just move it a bumper's width off the rail. You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah.
It's like we're going to play friendly pool. We're going to play fun pool. And if you play in your leagues, you know, and if I'm in a league and I'm playing with amateurs and recreational players and I'm winning and running multiple racks on people and everybody's like, I'm the MVP in the league and I'm playing some beginner that can barely draw his rock and he's going to make a mistake. Like in the context, you know, I could see doing that, but that's just not the context I play in.
Have you ever shot the wrong ball, Demi?
Of course, in a rotation game.
Of course. And you know what?
You have?
Of course. Yeah. And I mean, I think so it's all about context, but in the context of if we're asking what the right thing to do is, and here, let me tell you guys, I'm going to tell you something I think a lot of people have not thought about. And this is really, I'm passionate about this, and it has to do with why certain rules are bad rules. And what I call a bad rule is if there's a rule that penalizes honest players, then I don't like the rule. And let me tell you what the problem is. So let me tell you what the problem is with some rules that may need to be reevaluated. For example, no pattern racking, or if there's people that, let's say the rule is that you have to call foul on yourself, which is an etiquette thing. I don't mean to open that can of worms. But like in this case, if the rule is that you're supposed to warn your opponent, here's the problem with that. Let me use pattern racking as the easiest example. It's a rule that cannot be enforced because there's no way as my opponent, if I've got three balls that I want to interchange between a couple of positions of the rack, I can have, you know, three or four different patterns I like and then flip them around by rotating those three balls through those patterns. And bottom line is I can come up with, you know, anywhere from 5 to 10 to 20 unique variations of ball racks that are all effectively the same as far as how I want them. And so you're never going to see the same rack twice. And it's very hard for you to prove anything. And then on top of that, you know, even if I'm repeating the pattern, I mean, what are you going to be taking pictures and notes and get the tournament director? Like, how do you enforce that? And so here's the problem. When you have a rule that you can't enforce, then the people that follow that rule become at a disadvantage to the people that break that rule. And there are people that break that rule and pattern rack. And then so you've got people that are trying to do what they believe is right and getting eliminated. Now, this doesn't seem to most of our listeners, they're like, oh, who cares? It's pattern racks. And you know what? You just shoot pool and, you know, let the best man win. They don't realize at the professional level how big of an issue it is to give up an advantage on the break. The player that gets more opportunities will win the match. And this is, you know, you practice, you dedicate years and years and years of your life and travel around, and you're trying to fight to get in this top sliver of a percent to make a living at the game. And you've developed your skills to where you can play for hours without missing and run through 9-ball racks like water. And then you're going to get beat because a guy can tap open a 7-ball rack the right way every time. And he's going to break the rules and get away from it. And you're going to get eliminated because you don't break the rules. And so I think that's any rule that I get passionate because it's so bad, but any rule where you can, the players that break the rules get away with it, and the players that follow the rules get penalized, that's a bad rule.
How about this one?
And so hang on. So we can talk about rules like that, but my point is that if you make it an opponent's rule to call, if you made that an actual rule to say it's your job to tell somebody before they foul, well, then if they don't tell the person, then they get rewarded. But if they follow that rule and tell the person, then they pay the penalty of not, you know, being in their chair and watching the other guy run out. So I think the problem with this etiquette is that the people that break the etiquette are at the advantage. And so I, not only is it at the professional level, is it correct to, you know, to not, to play the role of the referee and not correct somebody for making mistakes. So not only is this the correct technical way to play it, but I think that it also is good in the sense that it doesn't penalize people who play by the rules. So those are my thoughts on it.
Yeah. Yeah. That, no, that, that is essentially exactly what happens also with any rule that, makes it a choice. Every rule should be a rule. You either break it or you don't.
Yeah, I want to follow the rules and not be eliminated because I do so.
Yeah, right, yeah. Be honest. We have a league rule as an example. That you have to. There's no safeties in this bar league. You have to make an honest attempt at pocketing a ball.
That is the worst rule in the world. And I'm telling you, I played. Listen, Rob, I played a ring game. So check this out. I played a 10-ball ring game tournament where you had like six guys on a table and you had poker chips and all this. I did this in Iowa like 10 years ago or something. Yeah. And we played ring game rules, honest effort, because you're playing in a ring game. There's no benefit to playing safe. Well, until we got down to the final two. And then we're heads up. And in the other ring game tournaments I've played, once we got the heads up, we just played like a race to 11 or whatever for the win.
Sure,
but in this one, they're like, no, you're going to play it out ring game style, which means you have to play honest effort.
Right.
I'm like, what do you mean you have to play honest effort in a heads-up game? Like, how? It's, there's a very fine line between a two-way shot and a safety. You know what I mean? And I'm like, well, this is like, and so I'm trying to, it's just a horrible spot. Anyway, yeah, that's ridiculous.
Yeah. So
that's a dandy.
Yeah, I guess we can wrap up this discussion there, and we can go into our two tips. So, Rob, would you like to start out?
Well, I'm going to gear this tip to the players who are reaching the age of senior players, getting into that category. That would be probably, 55, 60 and older, and even a little bit older than that. You got to kind of think like an 18-year-old. Which is very difficult to do when you're 60. They seem to have an ability to not go beyond what's exactly in front of them. In other words, you hear about, you know, playing pool in that exact moment of time. Not thinking before or after or just that moment. And it seems to me, watching the younger players, it's so easy to do that. If you're young, and so tough to do it if you're old. So my advice is have a positive distraction with you of some type to kind of trigger you to think like a fearless younger player. Very difficult to do. As you get older, we tend to fear more things because we have less time left. So try to overcome that for all the guys out there who are over 60. You know, I use hypnosis as a substitute for pure mental toughness. So that's all I got on that.
So my tip this week is going to be, so when playing 8-ball especially, you're always going to have a million different opportunities to run out of a rack. That's hyperbole slightly, but it's not super far off. The idea is there's always going to be, of course, one best way to run out, and that is, you know, 8 stop shots or whatever it is. There's going to be one best way, but there's a bunch of other different ways to get out from a rack. And so with optimizing your ability to run out, you should be playing positioning on as many balls as you possibly can. So what I mean by that is, let's say you have to go to a rail and back out. You got to travel a foot to a rail and then a foot and a half off of that rail to play positioning on one ball. Or you could try to travel your cue ball, let's say 5 feet, and into that 5 feet, it puts you into middle level line. And if you go, let's say 8 feet, or you go 3.5 feet, you have shots on 5 of your last 6 balls. It is definitely a better idea to have your cue ball travel a little bit further so that you have actual wiggle room to, you know, if you go a little longer, you go a little short, you have other options available to you, as opposed to if you end up shorter, you end up long on one ball, you have nothing. So when you're picking your 8-ball runouts, pick your 8-ball runouts in a way that if you go a little bit long or a little bit short, and usually want to go about 15%, because 15%, so if you're traveling, so for example, if you're traveling 10 feet, 15% would be 1.5 feet. So if you travel 1.5 feet long or 1.5 feet short, you still have options available to you that may not be the ball that you're looking at shooting next, but you still have options available so that you can run out of a rack if you get a little shorter or a little long in your positioning. So that'll be my advice, is try to look at 8-ball patterns in a more complex way, to where if you end up 15 to 25% long or short, you still have options, and you're not putting all of your eggs in one basket of one single ball that if you come up short or long on, you have no other options.
I like that.
Have a second parachute.
Yeah. So with that, we can wrap up our two tips, and we will head into Demetrius's Coach's Corner.
All right. Welcome to another Coach's Corner. Very excited. Demetrius Gelatis here with MN Pool Bootcamp, helping bring your game to the next level as the target. So this week, I am going to bring up something about, on the mental game side. And I'm excited about the Coach's Corner in the sense that I can take on some of the mental side of pool. One of the challenges is that with learning to play good pool is that you can watch what top players do physically, but you don't get to really see how they think or how they're approached the game mentally. And there's a huge gap in thinking between recreational players, amateur players, and professional players. And the more clearly you can look at the game, the better your pool game will follow your mind. So it's a hard subject to start getting into. It can be organized in many different ways, but this week I want to focus on just one specific aspect of that. And this is because of our conversation about how many times the top players fail. I want to talk a little bit about our attitude towards failure and how we can embrace failure. And so I think this is something that stops a lot of players, is that most players, they want to win. I mean, that's what they want. They want to hit their result goals. They want to hit their accomplishments. They want to win tournaments. They want to win matches. And they think that winning is good and that losing therefore is bad. And they would like to find a way to win, but they're afraid of losing and they don't like losing. And that poses a problem. And the problem is there is no road to success that is not absolutely paved with failure. And so that's it. There's just everybody, all the top players, they didn't get there because they just won more. They won more because they lost more and they missed more balls and lost more matches. That's it. The road to pool greatness is failure, 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 win, failure, 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 win, miss, you know, it's just and chokes and miscues and epic meltdowns and, huge leads that were squandered and all these different things. All those mistakes are made along the way. And you can't really just get the cherry pick the wins and say, okay, so how does this play out? I see this play out. There's kind of one of three attitudes you could have. Some people are so afraid of the losses that they just don't compete. And it's like, well, why would you be that afraid of loss? And I think I've given a lot of thought to this, and it really kind of comes down to, they actually don't even believe that they're actually good enough to ever win. They're like, yeah, winning is something that happens for other people. I don't know if I could ever do that. Could I ever be the guy that wins? Could I ever be the guy? Who am I kidding? And they don't believe that they're a winner. And the reason that they don't believe that they're a winner is because they believe that winners are people that never lose. And so that's true. If a definition of a winner is somebody that never loses, then it's true. They're not a winner because they're not some guy that's just never going to lose. So then they're like, because they have losses and because they know that they're going to lose sometimes, they're like, yeah, there's something wrong with me because I'm not a winner like those guys that always win. And so I don't know if I want to play, because if I play, then I could risk loss. And every time they lose, it's really, really painful, because in their mind, if I lose, that just proves that I guess I'm just not one of those winning guys because here I am just this loser. So I just, you know what I'll do? I want to avoid losing, so I won't play. And I've seen this again and again where I've got guys who I ask them what their goals are. Like, well, I'd really like to win a local tournament with some top players in it, and that would be very meaningful to me. And then I ask them, how many times have you played a tournament in the last year? They're like, well, you know, maybe zero or maybe one. Like, they just, I don't really play many tournaments. And it's like, well, that's not going to get you there. So obviously, like, what's keeping you back? Like, it's very clear you're not going to hit your pool goals without competition. Why aren't you competing? And it's like, well, because if they compete, they're going to lose. And if they lose, then they think that that proves that there's something defective and they're just one of those players that doesn't have what it takes to be a success. And so bottom line, that's one strategy of handling loss in pools to not play and run from that. And then the second strategy is to delude yourself and pep talk yourself and be like, tell you what, you hate to lose. You don't want to lose because it's going to prove you're a failure. But what you can do is you're just not going to lose. You're going to win it this time. Don't worry. This is your day. You're going to get it. And they like slap themselves in the face and pump themselves up and like, today I'm going to win. 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 And then they go into this tournament like just terrified that they're wrong and that they're going to lose and get heartbroken. But they're like, no, I think I can. I think I can. Today I'm a winner. I'm going to prove I'm a winner. I'm the guy that never loses. I'm going to win today. And then they go out there and there's this huge problem with this mindset, which is when you're not realistic, you've got your delusion. You've got this, you know, fantasy or this, you know, imaginary land that you're trying to convince yourself that you're the main character of a movie and you're going to make the three-pointer at the buzzer. But the problem is reality is there trying to intrude. And the reality is other players that you can't control are going to do what they're going to do, and they're trying to eliminate you from the tournament, and odds are it'll happen, and odds are you're going to lose. So when your dream that you're trying to believe in collides with the reality that's bursting in, it creates very unpleasant situation, and it puts a lot of pressure on you if you're so terrified of loss that you think that a loss means that you're a failure as a human and as a player and that you're never going to hit your pool of goals and everything's horrible in the world. Then if that's how much pressure is on you on every shot, is that every miss threatens your whole universe, then that's it's hard to play freely and confidently with that kind of tension. And so strategy one is to not compete. Strategy two is to try to delude yourself into thinking you're never going to fail and that today's your day, which just creates a ton of pressure, causes meltdowns, and a lot of pain after the fact. The third strategy towards failure is to say, I understand that you can't have success without failure. But also, I understand that you can't have failure without success. And so rather than trying to find a way to cherry pick the successes out without getting stung by the thorns of failure, how about I just embrace failures. If I'm going to have 9 losses for every win in a tournament or 19 losses for every tournament win, what stops people in their road to success is not the successes, it's the failures. And if you understand that, you say, tell you what, forget about trying to get the wins. I don't need to try to get the wins. The wins will happen when they happen. Why don't I just go try to collect failures? Why don't I go out and try to fail out of 19 tournaments? Because if I can go fail out of 19 tournaments, odds are I'm going to end up winning something, and someday somebody will hand me an envelope of money and take my picture, and that'll be pretty cool. But, like, that's not the reality. The reality is not that I'm the player that's always going to win, but the reality is that if I enter enough tournaments and give myself enough at-bats and I'm okay handling the losses and I'm not putting extra pressure on myself and I'm not letting this deter me from competition, then the reality is that I will get better and I will achieve some amazing things in pool. And so my advice would be to collect losses and to embrace losses and look at them as steps in the right direction, not steps in the wrong direction, not steps that something's wrong, but steps that something's right. Because all the great players I know laugh off failure and they, it doesn't break their stride and they regroup hard and they're just like, well, they come back strong the next time, and it doesn't change their image of themselves because they're realistic and they know that that's part of what's going to happen. And the players that I see that are trying to be the guy that doesn't fail, those are the people that I see getting stagnant, avoiding competition, putting too much pressure on themselves, playing too intermittently and playing too tight. And so I think that instead of trying to hit the successes in pool, I say you go out and collect failures and go try to lose out of your next tournament. Go try to make your choke on your next 9 ball. You just go collect the chokes and the losses and smile about it, because there's going to be a lot of them. And if you go try to collect a lot of those, if you can collect more miscues, choked nine balls and losses than anyone else, odds are you're also going to end up with more wins, just as an inevitability. So that's my advice. And once again, Demetrius here with MN Pool Bootcamp. You can check out my website, www.mnpoolbootcamp.com. And by the way, I'm not just providing local instruction. I do boot camps for players across the country. So I love hearing from people from coast to coast. You know, summertime's coming pretty soon. Love to have you guys book a few days, come train with me, and help me. I can help you take your game to the next level. Thanks.
Okay, fellas, been great talking with you again today, and all the listeners out there.
Yep.
Hope you got something out of it.
Yep. Thanks for joining us again this week, guys, and till next week. Hey everyone, thanks again for listening. If you like what you've heard and you listen through iTunes, please subscribe and leave a rating. It helps others find the podcast. As always, thank you to our sponsors, Jacoby Custom Cues, Cody's Cue Therapy, Jeff Glaz's CBD for Life Global, the Wisconsin Billiards Hall of Fame, The Rocks Sports Bar and Grill, the IQ Practice Cue Ball, and the Wisconsin Pool Player Society. If you like what you hear, consider supporting the people who support the podcast. I would also like to take this time to thank Matt Kitzman, Robert Miller, Natasha, Kurt Elliott, Scott Doolian, Corey Smith, William Sutherland, and Mike Teasy for their help to market the podcast to a larger audience. Lastly, I would like to thank my cousin Andrew Mindham for his band Hey Captain Knight's music as segment and filler music to the podcast. If you like what you hear, you can find all of his music at heycaptainknight.bandcamp.com. And Knight is K-N-I-G-H-T.